KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Women are fighting, they're dying, and they've shown they have great skills.
Watch carefully while this story comes to life.
Why this man at this time in this place? Why Muhammad in Mecca in the 7th century? I want to know, as it were, what it was to be Muhammad.
Leslie Hazelton talking about the first Muslim, the story of Muhammad. We're going to talk to her in a little bit. We're also going to talk about The Shadow, the old-time radio show. And you heard retired General Richard Myers talking about women in combat. And we start there this hour on weekday. I'm Steve Scher. As you have been hearing all morning, the Secretary of Defense, Leanne Panetta, says the Pentagon has dropped its ban on women in combat positions. Panetta says allowing women to serve in combat will strengthen the U.S. military and our ability to win wars. He said they have proven their ability to serve in an expanding number of roles. He was speaking at a Pentagon ceremony in remembrance of Martin Luther King Jr. He said the military is more capable and more powerful when we use all our great diverse strengths of the American people. Last November, we talked to Captain Zoe Bedell. She was one of four servicewomen, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, who sued Defense Secretary Leon Panetta over the military's policy of excluding women from combat. The ACLU and the plaintiffs said that the policy was unconstitutional. Marine Captain Zoe Bedell joins us on weekday to talk to us again. Captain Bedell, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
What do you feel with this announcement? How do you feel?
Yeah, we're thrilled. I mean, it was a complete shock, and we didn't see this coming, and it's really, this is exactly what we're hoping for. Sort of the next morning, you realize, okay, maybe cautious optimism. It's going to be a phased-in plan. There's still opportunities for the service chiefs to try to close off jobs. But as a step, it's a huge step forward, and I think it's really a positive development.
We don't know yet what it means for your lawsuit at this point, correct?
Yes, that's correct. You know, I think the lawyers are sort of trying to figure that out at this point.
One of the things we've been hearing, well, first of all, let's talk about why it is happening. It's happening because women like yourselves have been in combat in a war with no front lines, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, people think that this is a huge change, but really it's stuff that women have been doing for the last 10 years and frankly before that too.
You served as a member of the female engagement teams. You were training, you deployed with other Marines. What would be different in your role if this policy had been in effect?
It's hard to sort of go back and look at that retroactively, but certainly there were a lot of restrictions put on how we could operate. It was very confusing. Commanders were very hesitant to employ us to our fullest ability because they were concerned about, you know, violating the law, breaking the law. So it would have taken a lot of that extra complexity away from the situation and let us just be employed for what we brought to the table and the skills that we had.
Now, you left active duty for the reserves because of the combat exclusion policy. As it's implemented, will that change your plans for the future?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely one of the factors that led me to get out of the military. I think at this point, probably my ship has sailed. I'm sort of pursuing another career, and it would be very hard to go back to this at this point. So I think that opportunity has passed for me.
But you are a trained captain, and what all these people are talking about in putting this policy forward is the need for trained service members to remain engaged with the service, not lose that core of understanding of what we've gone through over the last 10 years.
No, and that's absolutely right. And, you know, as we're pulling out of Afghanistan and as we're reevaluating how much money we're spending, the military is going to get smaller. So I think this policy change comes at a good time because people can now decide whether to stay in or get out based on the real options in front of them and not based on, you know, one of the pieces in the calculus that as I was making my decision, you know, I'm not going to be treated equally. So I think this will really help the military as they trim down, help them maintain the best people.
Captain Zoe Bedell was commissioned as an officer in the Marine Corps in 2007. She was deployed twice to Afghanistan, where she served as officer in charge of female engagement teams. She's currently a captain in the United States Marine Corps Reserves. Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense, was the subject of the lawsuit that she and other plaintiffs brought along with the ACLU over the exclusion of women in combat roles. All right, so a couple of the, as you said, see how it's implemented and what the heads of the various services will or will not put into place. We've already heard these caveats about, well, maybe women can't be SEALs, maybe women can't be Green Berets. What do you make of those statements?
Well, you know, the official request to keep certain areas closed will come out in May, and we'll certainly be looking at that. I mean, there may be valid concerns there, but we've heard a lot of the same objections, you know, that have proven invalid over the years. So it'll definitely be something we're keeping a close eye on.
Can a woman carry a buddy who's injured? I don't know what the limits of the poundage is, but can a woman carry a buddy who's injured away? That's one of the things they talk about.
Absolutely. And the physical requirements are definitely important. And that's why, you know, we're not saying that there should be a minimum number of women or there's certain spots reserved for women. We've been looking for an opportunity to compete equally for these jobs. And that's what removing this policy, that's what it creates now. We have an equal opportunity to compete just like anyone else.
I forget what that, when we talked before, what does that mean for example, the requirements of numbers of push-ups, numbers of sit-ups, ability to run? Do you think that the women's standards should be brought up to the men's standards and be the same numbers there, or should there be something in the middle? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, and that's something the services are definitely looking at and evaluating themselves. You know, ultimately, I think it should be tied to the job that you're doing and what do you need to be able to do that job. And I think that's how they're thinking about it.
Is there any job that, I mean, so I don't know why they would say Navy SEALs or Green Berets. Does it have something to do with the physical aspects of those jobs that, that I'm not familiar with, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably, if they decide to close off those jobs, I'm sure that would be one of the arguments they would make, is that they're very physically demanding, and that, you know, the vast majority of women wouldn't be able to meet the standards. That would probably be one of the justifications. You often hear the unit cohesion justification, where, you know, introducing women to this tight-knit environment would be inappropriate and would weaken the unit. That one I have significantly less sympathy with, because we've seen time and time again that that's not the case. And it's also the same arguments they made when they were trying to exclude black people, for example, and that's been, or gay people, and those have just been proven over and over to be pretty ridiculous. So again, we'll have to see what those units are, and we'll have to see what the justification is.
Yeah, we'll come. Let me come back to unit cohesion in 1 minute. But in that vast majority of women, you said, may not be able to reach those standards, but there are probably some women that could reach those standards, right? Isn't that part of what we're learning here about ability and training and body type?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the fact is a vast majority of men can't meet those standards.
Right.
It's really hard, right? So give everyone a chance to try.
All right. What about unit cohesion? I mean, when they do bring that up, they talk about things like showers. They talk about things like toilets. They talk about things like having to share food in the dirt far away from a base. That seems remarkably sexist to me. I mean, wouldn't it all be, I mean, you're there, you do what everybody does, don't you?
No, that's exactly right. And the fact is, you know, it's already happening. Women are already there. This isn't something that, you know, no one's thought about for the last 10 years. It's something that women have been dealing with for the last 10 years and figuring out ways to make it happen. And everyone's been serving effectively and getting along just fine. So, you know, it's not like this is some new challenging problem that no one's thought of before today.
But that's the implication you hear. Oh, if women are let in combat roles, they're going to demand to be helicoptered back to the back line to do their nails and get showers every 2 days. I mean, that's the implication of the critique. But as you say, it's something else is already on the ground occurring.
No, that's exactly right. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite. You know, because of this policy, I actually had to chopper my Marines out every 45 days just for, you know, to avoid co-locating for too long. And it was such a drag, and we fought it every single time, and we didn't want to have to come out. And it was the opposite. Women were fighting to stay in these positions and stay in these hard conditions, not trying to get out.
Do you expect any women who are in combat to ask for special dispensations?
No, I'm quite the opposite. I think women in the military, we know we're a minority, we know we're under a lot of scrutiny, and we actually go out of our way to make sure we're not getting any extra considerations.
You know, And in terms of women in leadership in the military and women in combat positions in the military, once the training is the same, do you expect women to act any differently in combat than men? I don't mean in terms of bravery or cowardice. I mean in terms of decision making or the approaches taken to dealing with non-combatants, dealing with the combatants.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's two sort of elements of that, sort of like decision making in less stressful situations and decision making under fire. I think especially the decision making under fire, that's really training, and that'll come down to everyone's been trained the same and everyone's going to react as they've been trained to react. Rather, in the decision making and sort of the collaborative efforts, I guess studies have shown that women and men respond differently, but that they're both effective, and that a unit that or a company, you know, because it's mainly been in the business sector, that is able to take advantage of both of those perspectives is stronger as a result of it. But ultimately, you know, we all go through a lot of training on decision making and on leadership, and I think that training will be the deciding and dominant factor.
Captain Bedell, when people talk about unit cohesion, they're also, in a sense, talking about a boys' club, a frat boy mentality. I mean, I, this is my bias, but that's sort of what I hear them saying, like, oh, we're all guys together, and a woman coming in will change that. How do women change the way soldiers, Marines, get along in their units?
That's a great question. And from what I've seen, and this may not be comprehensive, but it really makes things become more professional. You don't have to lose the fact that you're friends or you have a sort of a special bond. But you start thinking of yourself more as a professional rather than a bunch of, you know, college boys hanging out at a frat, which is really not what we want our armed forces to be, you know, modeling themselves off at anyway. And I've seen that now that I've switched to the civilian side, and I really am obviously working in a fully integrated environment. And the Marine Corps and the military generally prides itself on its professionalism, but, you know, we've got a long way to go. And I think this maybe will help move it in that direction.
Might also have an effect on the kinds of treatment we hear women receive and the sexual harassment and more that women undergo in the military.
Yeah, and that's going to be a long-term issue. I mean, that's not going to be corrected overnight. But, you know, right now the policy is saying that women are second-class citizens. They're not equal. They don't have equal opportunities. And when the organization is putting out that message, that's picked up by the individuals. If an organization says, no, everyone has an equal chance to compete, you know, that filters down to the people as well. And I think that will help. It's not going to fix it. It's not going to be overnight, but it will help, you know, begin to eliminate that culture where sexual assault and sexual harassment are acceptable.
What are you doing now, if I may pry for a moment?
I'm actually in finance now, so definitely a bit of a different world, but still generally male-dominated.
one more crusade to take up. All right, Captain Bedell, I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Captain Zoe Bedell was commissioned as a Marine officer in 2007. She served twice in Afghanistan. She left after active duty for the reserves. Because of the combat exclusion policy, she was part of a lawsuit against Leon Panetta. That's still ongoing. We see what happens there. But the U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says the Pentagon has dropped its ban on women in combat positions. Speaking at a Pentagon ceremony in remembrance of Martin Luther King, he said the military is more capable and more powerful when we use all of the great diverse strengths of the American people. This is Weekday.
Well, women in combat, what do you think about this? As we've been hearing, the Pentagon says women in the military will be allowed to serve in combat as soon as 2016. Do you think women should serve in combat? Why or why not? If you're a woman who's served in the military, what does this mean to you? Share your thoughts by calling 206-221-3663. Tell us what you think about the idea of women serving in combat. 206-221-3663. We'll be discussing this issue further this afternoon at 12:40 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedvig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theater, starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theater, now through January 27th. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
46 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says expect clouds through the day, then rain overnight with a low of 40. It's 10:19. I'm Bernard Bullett. The sound of a roadside wedding in Cambodia is not something you hear every day, but you're going to hear it today, just about 35 minutes from now.
So that's one of Willie Weir's sounds of the day.
Yep.
Willie's back. I actually had a beverage with him. He's going to come on and talk to us in a few weeks about what he and Kat saw there, his wife Kat, and how they got what kind of reaction they got to the people as they brought their cameras and their sound equipment into some places that don't always see that kind of stuff. So more from that, and we'll hear that sound a little later. Right now, The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad, Leslie Hazelton's new book. It's good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Hazelton has covered the Middle East from Jerusalem during the turbulent span of 1966, 1979. She's been in the New York Times, Harper's Time, New York Review of Books. She was Town Hall Seattle's inaugural scholar in residence. That was great.
That was wonderful.
Her previous book, After the Prophet, The Epic Story of the Shia-Sunni Split, and Jezebel, The Untold Story of Israel's Harlot Queen. You are fascinated by this area.
It's been going on a long time with me. I'm totally intrigued by this vast and volatile arena in which politics and religion intersect. It's huge.
Well, in reading this book, I find out that politics and religion in that arena were intersecting right at the moment when Muhammad comes on the scene. You know, you asked a question in a clip we raised. Why Muhammad? Why that place? Why that era? Please answer that question.
Okay, let's take some of the background here. Mecca, at the time Muhammad was born, and he was born an orphan, by the way, which is usually skipped over by most biographers, and I have no idea why.
You find it a critical aspect of his character.
Totally, totally key to understanding who he was, to understand what it meant to be born an orphan in that time and that place. It placed him on the margins. A priori, and also the rest of his childhood, which was very much, you know, his father died before he was born, his mother died when he was six, he was shunted from one household to the other. It gave him that outsider eye, which allowed him to see clearly what was happening in Mecca. And Mecca, in the early 7th century, was basically the equivalent of a Wall Street bull market. The Arabian equivalent of a Wall Street bull market. Money had taken over, and with it, of course, greed and corruption. And when Muhammad started preaching after the first revelation of the Quran, it was essentially a totally subversive message. It was a radical message. It was a radical protest against inequality, injustice, for equality, including, by the way, women's rights. And I know this will surprise many people. And it was addressed to everybody else, to the 99%. And, of course, it aroused great opposition from the 1%, as one might expect.
The reason it was the bull market, explain that. The Mecca and the people who were making money in Mecca had their financial interests across the region.
Oh, they did. I mean, we tend to look at at 7th century Arabia as though we're looking at the past through a telescope, but the wrong way, so as we make it smaller instead of larger. Mecca was a huge trading hub from the Yemen up to Damascus, which was a major, major city at the time, and on into the Byzantine Empire. So, and twice a year they organized these huge trade caravans, 2,000 camels at a time. Now, these were not just, you know, minor little things. They were gigantic. But at the same time that Mecca was also a trading hub, and of course lots and lots of money coming in from that, it was also a hub of pilgrimage because of the Kaaba, the shrine that existed before Muhammad.
The shrine to?
To Allah. Allah existed before before Muhammad. He was the one. Allah was, if he is the right, wrong pronoun, never mind. But Allah was the one supreme, omnipotent God who was beyond all human comprehension, beyond touch, which is why there were all these other sort of minor gods, I call them totem gods, that were being worshipped too, because they were the ones that you could approach, they were the ones that you could touch, you could sacrifice to, you could make pledges to, you could make oaths in front of and so on. You could actually touch them because they were stone. They weren't all those gilded statues of, you know, Hollywood imagination and so on. They were stone monoliths, and especially in the desert, that made them all the more impressive.
The monotheistic religions of Christianity and Judaism, the idea of monotheism was already percolating, in many religions, but I guess it wouldn't be monotheistic. It would have been, a supreme God over the other gods. Uh-huh. And that was part of what was happening across the region as well.
Absolutely. Allah is simply the Arabic equivalent of El in Sumeria and in Phoenicia, Elohim in Israel and the Hebrew nomenclature. And again, this idea of one supreme God was not unknown. I mean, it was prevalent. It was simply accepted. The issue was all these other sort of associates with God. I mean, imagine, for instance, it's like, you know, there's one name on the door of a huge law firm and everybody else is associates, junior partners and so on. And what Muhammad, of course, was preaching was that take all those other names out of the equation. There's just the name on the door.
So Muhammad, an orphan, an outsider, he also, though, in his family, rises up in the ranks. But the people who are the 1%, mm-hmm. there is a structure in this 1%, the Quraysh?
Quraysh tribe, right.
Who were they, and how did they influence what was happening in this world at that time?
They were the ruling tribe of Mecca. And in fact, Muhammad himself was Quraysh, except that he was born really on the margins of the tribe. And thus this intriguing, to me, this intriguing mix of insider and outsider. He's an outsider within the inside tribe. And as the story of his life goes on, he becomes the absolute outsider. In fact, he gets exiled from Mecca. I know it's called the Hijra, the emigration in Islamic tradition, but really it was exile, and he experienced it as exile. And then just 8 years later, he was exiled to Medina. He returns victorious. Just 8 years later, acclaimed as the ultimate insider. I mean, it's an amazing story.
Muhammad was somebody who was, he was married to an older woman, somebody you say he loved and was his first love, his true love. Do you say that?
True love? Indeed. It's absolutely true. He was... This comes as a surprise to many people I know because there's this image of Muhammad as the, you know, lecherous polygamist and so on. In fact, his first marriage...
In the West. In the West.
In the West, yeah. In fact, his first marriage to Khadija was a loving, monogamous relationship that lasted 24 years until her death. Only after she died, in the last 10 years of his life, did he marry 9 other wives, and most of those were political alliances of the type that any leader at the time basically had to contract, and by then he had become a leader.
Leslie Hazelton is the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. What were your sources?
Ah, well, this is almost a kind of well-kept secret in the West. There are two wonderful sources. One is by Ibn Ishaq, a biography of Muhammad written in the 9th century and translated into English by Alfred Guillaume, and that's available in bookstores, The Life of Muhammad. And the other is in a rather daunting 40 volumes in English. It's a translation of the history of early Islam by Al-Tabari, and that was the result of a huge effort throughout the 1990s under the editorship of Ehsan Yashater. And these two sources are, okay, they're difficult to read for Westerners who are used to linear chronological narrative. They're very sort of almost, to use a malapropism here, Byzantine in their structure. They sort of weave back and forth in time and chronology. But they are basically oral histories, and they are incredibly inclusive. So you might get 12, even 20 versions of the same event, told from different points of view and in different voices.
The one that was compiled in the 1990s, about the 40 volumes, but
It was written in the 10th century. In the 9th and 10th centuries.
And as you say, these are either people who were oral histories or first-hand accounts, or sometimes children.
Mm-hmm. First-hand accounts passed down through 3 or 4 generations. And each time, they're very, very careful to give what they call the isnad, which is the chain of communication. Like, I heard this from A, who heard it from B, who heard it from C, who was there when it happened. And then you get somebody else saying, well, I heard this from F, who heard it from G, who heard it from H, who was there when it happened. And then it gets even more complicated with all the different chains of communication. And basically what I was doing was I mean, I lived in the Middle East for quite some time. I've reported from the Middle East a lot. I've spent a lot of time working with the Bedouin. And from my knowledge of Middle Eastern culture and the place itself, and of course the politics and the history, is basically where it sounds real, you know, where it's clearly been rewritten due to piety or reverence, but where you get the real juice of it, the real vitality of somebody actually talking, is where I'm always looking for.
You have a pretty chilling series when he goes up, when he first comes down from whatever he's doing up in the mountain.
The first revelation of the Quran up in Mount Hira.
Where did that story first get told?
That's first told in Ibn Ishaq, which was written in the late 8th century. First written down, almost immediately. We hear it, there's various accounts of it, first in the voice of Aisha, the youngest of the late life wives, and then in the voice of another of his followers. But what fascinated me there was, imagine if you can, just a couple of years ago, here I am, this agnostic Jew, puzzling for months on end at what I knew was an unanswerable question, and that is, what actually happened on Mount Hira in the first revelation of the Quran? I mean, we have an account of it in Muhammad's words as related by others, and I've given this in the book, but still it's as related by others, and you can see that they're trying to translate the ineffable into concrete images that they can understand, like the angel Gabriel standing aside the horizon and actually speaking and so on. So I've explored this. This is perhaps obviously the most speculative part of the book, and I'm sure for some the most presumptuous part, trying to understand revelation, especially for an agnostic, to understand mystical experience in a rational way. This is not rational. But I think what I said in the book was that, you know, while many people may call this a fool's errand, I would much rather be a fool for trying than another kind of fool for not trying.
You know, this is a man, as you said, he's an outsider. He's already become a proven businessman. He knows how to, as you write, he knows how to run these great caravans. He knows how to represent other people's interests. What was it about the words he used that struck the vast majority of people? Because it was his language that first captivated them, right?
It was. And it's very, very hard to capture in English. The musicality, the alliteration, the assonance, the poetry of the original Quranic Arabic. And it was all the more striking coming from him because he was known, and again, it's that outsider background, he was known to be a very, very terse man who only spoke when necessary. He was the last person he expected ever to be a prophet, which is why during that first revelation, he was so sure that he had to be absolutely out of his mind. I mean, his reaction to it is so human and so sane.
What was it?
My God, God is speaking to me. I have to be out of my mind. And he was so afraid that this was so, that his first impulse was to leap off the mountain to his death, right? And it seems to me, as I say, completely sane. This terrifying thing is happening to you, this huge weight, according to his own report, is bearing down on him, sort of like trying to squeeze all the life out of him. And here's where I get into the whole thing of inspiration, sort of, which is either breathing in or being breathed into, is having this immense amount of air just forced into his lungs and into his being. This is where I'm trying to understand it. But his reaction to this, I think, is so convincingly human that there is no question in my mind that, as some anti-Muslim people maintain, he made it all up and so on and so on. No, that's obviously not so. Something clearly happened that night. Muhammad experienced it, and we have to respect his experience.
Leslie Hazelton's book is The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. When do the revelations, the things he says, when do they become, in your mind, as somebody who's been reading it and studying it, more political, more focused on what revolution he's bringing to the culture.
Well, there are various interpretations that were political here. Certainly from early on, as I say, his message was radical. It was calling for equal distribution of wealth, equal distribution of respect.
Because, again, those people that ran the culture ran the culture.
Oh, yeah. They were completely in charge.
They told you what to do.
Yeah, which is why they set out. In fact, if they hadn't opposed him quite so openly, it's quite possible that we would never have heard of him today. But what they did is what happens when you take too strong a stand against somebody or something. The level of verbal and physical harassment of both him and his early followers built up to such a degree that it resulted at the end in a sort of concerted attempt on his life, which forced him into exile in Medina. And here I think you have to take the psychology of exile into account. And obviously my background as a psychologist comes into play here, but also my fascination as someone who's lived in on three different continents with the whole idea of exile and what home means and so on. I don't think any biographer ever can write entirely objectively. There's always something that, you know, you see of yourself in there, or you're interpreting through your own eyes. But the exile in Medina, this is where the Quranic revelations, which were ongoing, become much more clearly political. They're concerned with establishing a whole new community of Islam and with the rules for that community and the standards and the norms for that community and so on. They're much more concerned with ongoing events like various battles with Mecca during those 8 years until he came back to Mecca, and Mecca acclaimed him as their leader.
Is the language different? Is the poetry still there?
Less so. The earlier, and you can distinguish in the Quran between the earlier, more mystical revelations, let's say, and the later, more practical ones. And it's hard for an English reader, because the Quran was arranged after Muhammad's death. The chapters were arranged by length, with the longest ones first and the shortest ones at the end. And as a general rule, but this is not a complete rule, but what this means is that the longer ones tend to be the more openly political, practical ones, which were the later ones, and the shorter ones, which are towards the end, are the more mystical ones. So in a way, without any disrespect, if someone wants to understand, an English speaker wants to understand the appeal of the Quran to those early listeners, the ones who first heard it, and of course it was completely oral, you know, what he was told was, I mean, Quran means recitation, and what he was told on the mountain was recite, ikra, right? Not write, recite. Because this was an oral culture. So if somebody really wants to understand or to grasp the mystical appeal of the Quran, in a way it's best if they begin, as it were, at the back and read it as though it were still in Arabic from right to left, because those shorter surahs, shorter chapters at the end are much more mystical.
All right, I want to ask you about violence and how Islam evolved. And after a while, the character, the person of Muhammad is in this book, I mean, is part of a historical flow of events. Mm-hmm. Like, we see him sometimes less clearly, right, because the some accounts must be less clear, but there's the massacre of the Qurayz.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Jewish tribe, but this Arabia you talk about is Christian, Jewish. It's, it's many faiths and groups, different tribes.
Yeah,
you write about it in a sense. You say that the one thing all such explanations of why this took place have in common is an almost desperate attempt to make the unpalatable somehow less so. What did that event tell you about where Muhammad was going and where, I don't know if the same thing is true, where Islam was going? I don't know if that's the same thing.
When Muhammad first went to Medina, there were three Jewish tribes in Medina, but they were very much the minority there. They had been the majority, and over the years they had become the minority by the time he got there. And I think when he got there, he expected wholehearted support from them. I mean, his prophets were their prophets. One-third of the Quran is basically a reprise of biblical stories, mainly from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Bible. And it seemed natural that these monotheists would support him, but it's as though he hadn't taken into account that so far as they were concerned, the age of prophecy had ended with the exile in Babylon. So, and they weren't ready for a new prophet, especially one who wasn't himself Jewish. So there was a certain tension already there. And then it's too complicated to go into now, but the whole political setup in Medina, they were under the protection of one of his main political opponents in Medina. So basically, those tribes, I think, became, as it were, the pawns in a power struggle. But also, and I think far more important, is that this is where early Islam begins to differentiate itself from what you might call its parent faith, which was Judaism, just as Christianity had to differentiate itself from its parent faith, which was also Judaism. It had to establish its own separate identity. And some historians have called this the break with the Jews. I think that's oversimplifying grossly. But yes, some kind of break had to occur. What happened with the Quraysh tribe was, there are many, many, many versions, but I think it has to be read in context.
All right, here I am out of time again. So let me ask you this last kind of question. We won't need to sum up the entire faith or how it works in the world today, but I'm curious about how you feel what you have learned about that we take into today from having done this research on the first Muslim.
Wow, it's pretty hard to say after you've lived with somebody, as it were, as a writer for 4 or 5 years, and then full time, and then written 100,000 words to boil it down to what you have learned.
Well, you don't have to give it all to me.
What I am delighted with, because when the first hard copy of the book arrived, this gorgeous cover, I actually sat down and read it for the first time. Bound, you know, printed as an object in itself, as I read somebody else's book with a pencil in hand. And I was just delighted to realize that I'd actually done what I had set out to do, which was to see Muhammad whole, to see him in full, to accord him the integrity and respect of a full life lived. He came alive on the page for me, and I hope he does for other people too.
Leslie Hazelton will be talking about her book at Town Hall tonight at 7:30, The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? We're going to dial the radio back to the 1930s in a minute, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
There's still time to make a charitable gift from your individual retirement account. The IRA charitable rollover has been extended, and your gift can still qualify for 2012 tax benefits if made by January 31st. For more information, go to kuow.org/support-future.
Dror Moreh interviewed 6 former heads of the Israeli secret service, the Shin Bet, about the price of their life's work.
If there are people who understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on all its aspects, it's those people who spoke in the film.
The new Oscar-nominated film, The Gatekeepers, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support from Hammermill Paper.
46 degrees in Seattle with some clouds and a sunbeam. Forecast says we're going to have at least some amount of clouds hanging around through the rest of the day, with a predicted high of 46, which is where we're at right now. 10:43. The White House is speaking out today on North Korea's plan to conduct a third nuclear test, calling the plan needlessly provocative. More on that in about 15 minutes.
The Shadow appeared on the radio July 31st, 1931, on CBS. Katie Sewell's been thinking about The Shadow on radio for our radio retrospective segment, Back to the Golden Age. Why do you like the shadow? Or, you know, let me rephrase that. Do you like the shadow?
I actually prefer not to listen to the shadow.
Really?
Yes, but I've gotten so many requests.
I like the
for
shadow.
The shadow on this segment that I decided to bend to the pressure.
I like to hear Orson Welles as the shadow because it makes me think about him before he was Boy Genius.
I would love it if people, though, would email us and tell us why, when they think of old-time radio drama, they think of the shadow.
I think because it was repeated so often in the 60s and 70s. It was something that there must be a lot. Must have been many, many recordings of it that were saved.
Yes. Well, let's start at the beginning, shall we? Back in 1931, when the shadow first appeared on the air, he actually wasn't a character. He was just a phantom host of the Street and Smith Detective Story Hour, which was a radio adaptation of Street and Smith's publication of a pulp mystery magazine. It was actually the first mystery magazine that had ever been released. And Frank Reddick was the shadow's voice at that time.
This is the shadow. Money. Thousands of dollars in vaults. A woman greedy for love, for gold. Watch carefully while this story comes to life.
See, so he's just the announcer, and then he would go into a whole different show with a whole cast of characters. And he was an announcer for hire. He also introduced the Street and Smith love story dramas, which was something that the fans and critics alike both did not appreciate.
Wait, with the same voice?
Yes, he was just the sinister host of the Street and Smith story hours. One critic wrote that this was his quote. He said, "What a loss to fandom when the shadow tottered from his underworld throne into those Street and Smith love stories." Frank Reddick's portrayal of the shadow was so sinister and intriguing, as you heard there, that the listening audience actually became more intrigued by the host of the show than they were by the mystery stories themselves. Remember this iconic line?
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
That's Frank Reddick in 1934. I read that he, to get the echo in his voice a little bit, he used to read that with a glass of water by his mouth.
Oh, really?
Which is kind of interesting.
That makes sense.
So as he becomes more popular, people start going to the newsstands asking for the Shadow's mystery stories, which didn't exist, rather than the Street and Smith mystery magazine. And it wasn't really hard for Street and Smith to see the profit potential there. You know, it was time to make the Shadow into a full character. So in March 1931, they launched the Shadow magazine, which was written by a journalist and magician on his side named Walter Gibson, writing under the pen name Maxwell Grant, and he was the one that invented the shadow that we remember.
The shadow, Lamont Cranston, a man of wealth, a student of science, and a master of other people's minds, devotes his life to righting wrongs, protecting the innocent, and punishing the guilty. Cranston is known to the underworld as the shadow. Never seen, only heard. His true identity is known only to his constant friend and aide, Margot Lane.
They had to have a backstory, Katie.
So ridiculous.
Even a silly backstory.
Walter Gibson actually did not invent Margot Lane. That was one of the only characters he didn't come up with. She appeared only on the radio. She was not in the comic books. She was not in the magazines at that time. Radio producer Clark Andrews was the one that came up with her, and she was modeled after the character, or the character actor on Broadway, Margot Stevenson. And when the show went on the air, Agnes Moore had originally held the role of Margot, but since the character was based on Margot Stevenson, it wasn't really that long before the producer gave the role to
that
Margot
sounds
Stevenson
like a little
instead.
Backroom stuff that the shadow would know about.
Shall we listen?
Oh, Lamont, that's the dullest thing I've ever heard of. A director's meeting at a chess club.
Well, nothing dull about it. You see, there's quite a feud going on down there.
The trouble, dear, did someone try to change the color of the squares?
Yeah, that's Margot Stevenson.
She called him dear. What was their relationship?
Hazy at best.
Hazy.
They're partners.
Yeah, very hazy.
So that's William Johnstone playing the shadow. He only held the role for 5 years until 1943. Brett Morrison was actually...
What happened to Frank Reddick?
Well, Frank Reddick actually kept doing the intro. but he was not the actual shadow in the
wow.
dramas. So that's his voice at the beginning.
He kind of got cut out, didn't he?
Brett Morrison was the actor that held the role the longest. He played it from 1945 to 1954. And the sad thing for him, having played that role for so long, is that when people think of the shadow, they still think of the very first one, which was Orson Welles. So here's a little clip from the very first episode of the revamped Shadow in 1937 called Death House Rescue with Orson Welles.
Hello?
Say, what are you laughing at? Who is this?
Did you ever hear of the Shadow?
Say, what is this?
Too bad about young Gordon.
What do you know about that?
The Shadow knows.
Who are you? What do you want?
I want justice.
Orson Welles was only 22 years old when he was playing The Shadow, and his contract allowed him to skip the rehearsals entirely. So he usually arrived just a few minutes before airtime, and he always claimed that not rehearsing that role was way more interesting because he would, as he put it, if you threw me down a well into some fiendish snake pit, I had no idea how I was going to get out. So during the live broadcast, he's just finding out what the Shadow's doing along the way, which is it's a way to do it.
Yeah, if you don't want to rehearse.
Yeah, he was a professional, quote unquote, right? So to end, let's look at two things that the Shadow inspired out of this. The first was back when the Shadow was just an announcer, he inspired a whole host of sinister hosts that opened radio programs, countless radio mystery programs. I put together a little montage of some of those sinister hosts just to entertain us.
This is the Man in Black, here again to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense.
I am the Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night.
Good evening, friends of the inner sanctum. This is your host to welcome you through the squeaking door.
This is the mysterious traveler, inviting you to join him on another journey into the realm of the strange and terrifying.
Turn out your lights. Turn them out. Then listen while the hermit tells you the story.
The hermit.
The hermit's cave.
Wow, they went all the way.
Just a smattering. There are so many more.
That's
when you really start looking. But those all grew out of the popularity of the Shadow introducing those mystery stories. There were some contemporary versions of that on television, like The Twilight Zone or Tales from the Crypt. We seem to maybe have fallen out of favor with that notion. I was having a very hard time coming up with somebody who's doing it currently. So if anybody has any ideas, let me know. But perhaps more importantly, and most currently, without the Shadow, we would have never had this guy.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Batman would not have come about without the Shadow.
You sounded like you were in a cave just like the Shadow just
said. Yeah, that's nice. When Bob Kane and Bill Finger came up with Batman, they set out to create something that was like the Shadow. That was their intention. And Bill Finger even admitted that his very first Batman script was a takeoff of a Shadow story. And just to bring it full circle, in Batman issue number 253, Batman actually meets the Shadow and admits to the Shadow that he modeled himself after the Shadow's example. So, if you like Batman, you should be thankful for the Shadow. That's the long and the short of it.
I have to think about whether I accept that the Shadow... I mean, I understand that.
I mean, you can see it. Lamont Cranston, wealthy young man about town, leisure time, decides he's going to fight crime. Batman's exactly the same way.
Yeah. Better backstory for the Bat.
Yes, better I would backstory. Argue. But again, please do tell me why you love the Shadow so much, everybody.
All right. Writer. Writer, weekday at KOW.org.
Yep.
Weekday at KOW.org. And tell us why you like the Shadow.
Yes.
Maybe post on the Facebook page. Have you put anything on the Facebook?
I did. You can post it on the Facebook
weekday
page.
Weekday on KOW Facebook page. We want to hear why you love the Shadow.
The sound of the day.
think when I was talking to Willie Weir yesterday, he said that almost every recording he had, somewhere in it, there was the sound of a motorcycle, and we just heard it there. Today's sound comes from Willie Weir when he was in Cambodia, a roadside wedding. Tents are set up, speakers are raised on poles, music is blasted throughout the community. When Willie recorded the sound, the wedding party was out on the side of the road waiting to enter the big tent. There were many gifts for the bride and groom as well, baskets of fruit, a case of beer, two live ducks in a basket. So what sounds are you hearing from your travels, motorcycles or not? Record 30 seconds of it and send it to us, along with the story behind it, won't you? Sound of the day in the subject line, email it to weekday@kuow.org. And after this long and fruitful day, I feel like lunch would be fun. Sarah Dickerman is a food writer. She's been a chef. She writes for Slate, the New York Times, other publications. She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. She joins us with a place to go eat, Sarah?
I do. How would you like a big bowl of warm noodle soup?
Always. Always.
I know. I pretty much feel like that's the soup. That is the thing that I could eat happily every day of my life. And,
me too.
In this case, it's ramen. I'm thinking about a new ramen place over in Bellevue. And it's a part of a Japanese chain called Kukai Ramen, and it's a cute space in a mini mall, and it is not the place to go if you only have 20 minutes for lunch, because it has been quite popular. So there's one of those waiting list situations when you get there. But that said, it's delicious ramen. They sort of match different ramens to different broths. I mean, different noodles to different broths. So I had the Shio ramen, which is the sort of slightly lighter ramen broth with bonito flakes to flavor it. It had a very, classic round springy noodle, delicious and slippery, but still a little bit of a bouncy bite to them. And we had a really nice time, and I went with my kids, and they were all over the karaage chicken, which is the, the fried chicken. And they also serve noodles that are not in broth that you can dip into broth, and those are a wider, more fettuccine-like shape, and those were also delicious.
I think it's great that after all this time with pho and ramen and the other soups, there are still places that we can find that can excite us and that are fun and that are interesting and surprises, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice to have something new. Doesn't mean that we don't love old, familiar places, but I think it always brings a little liveliness to the scene when something new opens up. And there were just nice details. The tea was delicious. The greens were really fresh and yummy that they put on the ramen. Beautifully cooked soft-boiled egg served in the ramen bowls, and everyone had a really good time. And it is nice to have a place you can tote kids along and feel like it's a comfortable space too.
Very nice. Yeah, I liked one of the comments on Yelp said, "Finally, a place I can go to that has great ramen. I don't have to burn up gas to get there." So
yeah.
The point that it's in Bellevue.
Exactly. For me, it was definitely a road trip. But there's actually, oddly enough, that there's also a good Sichuan place in that same mall. It's near the Crossroads area, and there's a Sichuan chef restaurant across the way. So
that's great.
You can do more than one thing while you're there. I was happy to see it, and I'm sure it will get a little easier to get in as they get their the details of the waiting list. settled out, but in the meantime, if you have the time and you can be patient, it's worth a try.
Kukai Ramen, Izakaya in Bellevue, and you were thinking about a nice book, an Indian-inspired cuisine, huh?
Yeah. So I made a curry last night, and I have a go-to Indian cookbook that's Vijay's Indian Cuisine, which is from the restaurant in Vancouver. But the nice thing is that actually. This family has now opened a new restaurant in Seattle called Shonik down in South Lake Union, which I'll probably talk about in the future. But in the meantime, if you want to cook curries at home, it's a great resource. They're sort of modernized but still very traditionally made recipes for curries of all kinds. There's one that I love that's a that's a cilantro mint chicken curry. But there's a great goat curry. There's one with short ribs and a little bit of cinnamon in the curry. All sorts of really great ideas and make you want to get cooking.
That's great. Elegant and inspired Vidges Indian Cuisine, V-I-J-apostrophe-S, Vidges. Sarah Dickerman writes about food, eats food so that we can too. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. We're going to talk with Seth Meyers of Saturday Night Live tomorrow, and also Rob McKenna will give us an exit interview as Attorney General and gubernatorial candidate. It's all coming up tomorrow on Weekday. Talk to you then.
Comedy and politics. That's a combination I can get behind.
Comedy and politics, I believe, is going to be the name of your new show.
So stay tuned for that. It's 10:59. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has made the official announcement about the change of policy regarding women in combat. We're following this through the day, and we're going to get an update in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Boat Show, with more than 1,000 boats on.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.